Welcome to this session of Sensezone, which is called Church Discipline, a procedural overview. We have an hour, and we have three panelists. Nadine Hansen, who I believe many of you know from her involvement in the Kate Kelly case. Russell Osmond, the lead tenor in the Osmond Family Singers.
They're my cousins, let's be clear about
that. Since you all can read, and their bios are in the program, and we're starting a little bit late, we'll let this go without any further introductions. We will have a presentation by Nadine, followed by me, and then by Russell, and then we will open this to questions and hopefully answers. The session number is 213. This duty was thrust upon me because the chair was late, so did I miss anything else? Okay. Nadine?
Good morning. A number of years ago, an acquaintance sought me out to tell me about her experience with church discipline. She was an emotionally fragile woman who was probably clinically depressed and became involved in a sexual transgression. When she confessed to her bishop, he initiated disciplinary counsel, wherein she was essentially coerced into recounting the details of her indiscretion in front of four men who had authority over her. It was a painful and humiliating experience. "If I ever slipped again," she told me, "I would only confess to Jesus." What possible good could be accomplished by bringing a vulnerable woman who's already repented into a disciplinary council and basically humiliating her by making her recount these details? They wound up disfellowshipping her. And I've heard and read other stories, similar stories over the years, but this was really the first time when I sat down with somebody who had been truly damaged by the church discipline process. So just keep that in your mind as background. So as Bob mentioned, I've written now two briefs in support of Kate Kelly, one to her bishopric and another to her state presidency, which was filed last week. I called them a statement of support, but it was written in the nature of a brief. And I don't really have time in this session today to go into detail about what's in the brief. One of them is like, I don't know, I think 16 or 18 pages long, and one's 23 pages long. And if you want to read them, you can. They're on the internet, and I can tell you more about how to find them if you want to see them. But in general, In the first brief to her bishop, I talked a lot about how unfair the process is to really everyone, but to women in particular. First of all, the rules for church discipline are set out in a handbook that only 9 women in the entire church have access to. And that's the 3 women who are the heads of each of the organizations that women head. That's the distribution list. Now, of course, this is the information age, and so I was able to find it online, and by doing that, go through the rules and talk about how the rules have been violated in Kate's case. And the violations that I argued about included the way her state president had held her records, saying that Salt Lake was not involved, but Salt Lake has to be involved if they follow the rules, because you're not allowed to keep somebody's records if you don't, if the person isn't living in your boundaries, unless you get clearance from Salt Lake. So Salt Lake was involved at least to that extent. She didn't get proper notice of the disciplinary council from her bishop. Those were a couple of places where I felt like they actually violated the rules that are set forth in the handbook. And as I pointed out, it's troubling that even if she actually got notice, because she got an email about the court, it's still troubling that her bishop and state president were willing to violate the rules. And there are no checks and balances. They can just violate the rules with impunity because nobody really is looking over their shoulder or doing anything to try to enforce the rules. So anyway, after I wrote the first brief, and also with the story I told you at the beginning in mind, I decided to put up a website about church discipline, and it's called www.mormonchurchdiscipline.org. And I hope to collect stories. I'm not a very good webmaster. I've never created a website before, and it's not a great website in terms of the way it looks or the way it functions, and I've only got a couple stories up so far. But what I hope to do with that website is collect people's stories and let people tell us what's working with church discipline and what is not working. And I hope that by having a public discussion about it, we'll encourage the church to make some changes to the process. So most of what I'm going to say this morning is I'm going to read to you from my introduction on that website. I won't read the whole thing, but I've explained, according to the church, purposes of church discipline are, one, to save the souls of transgressors, two, to protect the innocent, three, to safeguard the purity, integrity, and good name of the church. So how effective is church discipline at accomplishing these goals? Do the policies benefit transgressors? Do they protect innocent church members? And do they safeguard the church? And if they do they do it in a way that's fair and that minimizes harm? And are there better ways of accomplishing the goals of church discipline? Is church discipline even necessary in the 21st century? Or is the idea of church discipline a relic of the past that should be abandoned in favor of privately counseling transgressors, public prosecution and exposure of creditors, and open discussion of the matters that affect the purity, integrity, and good name of the church? In a recent broadcast on KUER's Radio West, church spokeswoman Allie Eisen spoke about the positive effects of church discipline, indicating that the process can be transformative in helping people change their lives. I don't doubt that in some cases it is. In other cases, however, it is punitive, intrusive, and alienating. In public cases, such as those involving the September 6, who were disciplined in 1993 for their scholarly writings and critiques of church spiritual abuse, the good name of the church took beating as the media focused on the secretive and oppressive practice designed to silence dissent instead of addressing the reasons for the dissent. The website invites readers to tell their own stories, and there's an email address on there where you can send stories and tell and advise us whether it was a court of love. And what about apostasy? A catch-all word used to discipline those whose words or actions the church leadership finds troubling. Church rules define apostasy in a way that is wholly foreign to the traditional meaning of the word, which is the renunciation of one's faith. In Mormonism, the word means something entirely different. It is basically a public disagreement with church leadership. Mormon scripture mandates that no power or influence can or ought to be maintained by virtue of the priesthood, only by persuasion, long-suffering, by gentleness and meekness, and love unfeigned, by kindness and pure knowledge, which shall greatly enlarge the soul without hypocrisy and without guile. The scripture calls for persuasion, not punishment, of those who disagree with contemporary practices. Those who discover troubling historical facts, or those who think the church they love could do better in serving the needs of its members, would be better served, and the church would be better served, and people would listen to them and address the underlying problems. The excommunication of Kate Kelly has ripped open a 20-year-old wound that many Mormons believed had healed, given the existence of a free and open blogger knuckle. This website is a call for a public discussion of the benefits and detriments of church discipline in the hope that shining a light on the best and worst aspects of it will contribute to much-needed reforms. I do not pretend to have all of the answers about how the church could better accomplish its goals, but at a minimum, the process needs to move out of the shadows into a space of greater transparency and impartiality. As I see it, different aspects of church discipline need to be addressed in different ways. For people whose lives are troubled by sin and guilt, the strict confidentiality of the traditional confessional needs to be honored. I suggest that spiritual counseling by appropriate local leaders and professional counseling from trained therapists are better suited to encouraging life-changing thinking and behavior than church discipline. Such counseling needs to involve those whose lives are affected by the transgressor's behavior where appropriate. For those whose predatory practices place others in jeopardy, such as sexual or financial predators, appropriate law enforcement actions need to be taken to expose and prosecute wrongdoers and thereby protect future potential victims. Public knowledge of predatory acts seems to me to be a much more effective deterrent than church discipline. For those whose study of church history, doctrine, and contemporary practices has led them to feel the need to speak out to encourage honesty and reform, I suggest that the existing mechanisms for discussion and debate are woefully inadequate. That inadequacy has led to the robust online discussion of troublesome questions. But the discussion now takes place under a cloud of fear due to recent excommunications, and it's not just Kate's, there have been some others, and threats of excommunication, as in John Berlin, of course. This is not a healthy way for a faith community to resolve difficult questions and problems. We are long past the time when questions can be silenced or swept under the rug, and I suggest that open discourse with persuasion, meekness, and love and faith is a much more effective tool for reaching consensus than our public affairs diatribes designed to marginalize and label as apostates those who speak their truth with integrity and candor. I suggest at a minimum the following church discipline problems need to be addressed. 1. Church discipline should never involve a man discussing intimate details of another person's sexual behavior, especially if that person is young, female, emotionally vulnerable, or a victim of abuse. And there are instances, in fact, there's one of the stories that has come in on my website is basically where there was a victim of abuse who's being, well, the mother is being treated as the wrongdoer, and no action was taken against the molester. Such discussions are wholly inappropriate for anyone that is not a trained and licensed professional. 2, the secrecy surrounding church discipline needs to be discarded. It is unfair and unreasonable to hide the rules of church discipline in a book that is unavailable to those who are subjected to those rules. 3, to the extent that church discipline involves fact-finding, which it usually doesn't, but the process needs to be fair, and the judge not be the accuser. In Kate Kelly's case, her state president is her accuser, and now that she's been excommunicated by her bishop, who no doubt felt the need to excommunicate her because the state president directed him to hold the court, and now her appeal has to go to the state president, who is her accuser in the first place. That is argued in my brief about the unfairness of that. To the extent that church discipline involves fact-finding, the process needs to be fair. The judge should not be accused. I've said that already. Some aspects of church discipline harken back to a time in the 19th century when church courts literally adjudicated disputes among church members. But the fairness provisions of the Doctrine and Covenants that require half of the high council to speak for the accused have been effectively abandoned and replaced with a determination by the person convening the council, who is usually the accuser, which everyone else is expected to rubber stamp with a sustaining vote. In the case of apostasy trials, privacy concerns are not applicable and should be discarded. By definition, by church definition, apostasy is a public act. It should not be definable at the whim of a local leader. Rather, if there are going to be apostasy trials, they should be public. They should apply only to core doctrines, which are clearly stated and defined. And the accused person should be entitled to representation by a person well-versed in church core doctrines. Apostasy trials should be conducted by an apostasy court, one with expertise in the meaning of apostasy and a thorough understanding of what constitutes core doctrines. That would remove the problem of arbitrary decision-making by local leadership. In short, if there must be apostasy trials, there should be a fair process in a public forum that can build a publicly identifiable body of canon law and provide clear notice to all church leaders and members of exactly what constitutes apostasy. What we have now with ordained women is you have some bishops and state presidents who are basically considering all discussion of ordaining women to be apostasy, and they're taking away church callings and temple recommends. And then you have other bishops and state presidents who think, you know, this is really a topic whose time has come and we need to talk about it. And they're being very supportive of the members in their wards and stakes. And the arbitrary nature of calling something apostasy is one of the real problems in church discipline, which is why I propose that if we're going to do it at all, and maybe it's time to give that up, but if we're going to do it at all, we need to have some kind of standardized body of knowledge about what apostasy is. What we do now for church discipline might work well sometimes, but its success depends on the phenomena of leader roulette. And sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. While I know there are wonderful bishops and state presidents who truly bless the lives of those they're called to serve, the process is inherently fraught with potential for abuse, and there are no effective checks and balances. If there are things about the process that are working, fine. But it's time for the church to reconsider the potential harms and to reform the process, if not abandon it altogether.
Well, if you live long enough, you come to recognize there are various points in your life in which you live in interesting times, and you expect that those times will not be as interesting as they sometimes become. I begin with a quote from Pope Innocent III, written in 1215, a papal bull. "This Magna Carta has been forced from the king. It constitutes an insult to the Holy See, a serious weakening of the royal power, a disgrace to the English nation, a danger to all Christendom, since this civil war obstructs the crusade. Therefore, we condemn the charter and forbid the king to keep it, or the barons and their supporters to make him do so on pain of excommunication." So to be excommunicated, or the threat of excommunication over the Magna Carta, suggests that in human affairs dealing with judgment, sometimes people can be wrong. When I became bishop of the Los Angeles First Singles Ward in 1982, I didn't know anything about being a bishop. But the first decision I made was that I wasn't going to excommunicate anyone. While I conceived of the possibility of that happening from somebody who was perhaps predatory or egregiously abusive in some way, I knew something about the history of excommunication in the church, therefore decided that I wasn't going to excommunicate anyone. My resolve was tested very quickly, because in a singles ward, one of the things I did is to, since I didn't know many of the people in the ward, coming from a family ward, I did 15-minute interviews with everybody and said essentially, if there's anything in your past that hasn't been resolved, let's resolve it. Start with a tabula rasa. Start making a new beginning. And there was one woman who was living with a man in an intimate relationship. And I said, you know, this is not acceptable. You need to stop. And I gave her a period of time in which to do that. And in subsequent interviews, she didn't stop. And I didn't do anything. And it wasn't that I felt that that was the right decision. It's just that I wasn't sure what the right decision was. And I finally said, why don't you marry the guy? And she said, well, I would, but he doesn't want to be married. And, you know, we were in love, and she was a returned missionary. So I said, you know, you're putting me in a place where I'm going to have to do something that I don't want to do. And she said, I recognize that, and I'm willing to accept the consequence of that. And I didn't act. And then she moved out of the ward. And I felt as relieved as Kate Kelly's bishop should have felt. I'm sorry to do it. And as her Provo bishop would feel with her having going to move to Kenya, the manager. I completely forgot about that. And a number of years later, in visiting my daughter's ward, she said, let's go to gospel doctrine class. We went to gospel doctrine class, and it was a wonderful lesson. And I went afterwards and said, gee, you're such a good teacher. That was really an enjoyable lesson. And people had kind of cleared away. She said, you don't remember me, do you? I said, no, I don't. I mean, I was blessed with great ecclesiastical amnesia. And she reminded me of who she was. And I said, oh, that's very nice. I said, what's happened to you? And she said, well, the man I was living with joined the church, and recently we were married in the temple. I tell that story not because it was the right thing to do, but because it seems to me that in human affairs, things are extremely complex. And as a bishop, I didn't get any training except being handed the handbook. And so I didn't really know what I was doing. And my experience with a lot of bishops over the years is that a lot of them don't know what they're doing when it comes to church discipline. And sometimes, because of that, make errors that soon can be tragic. So my three reasons for not to excommunicate anyone is that I knew that from my experience of just studying church history that the excommunication of an individual often leads to the de facto excommunication of spouses, family, and friends. That if we don't stop to think about what happens if you excommunicate a father or a mother and how it affects the children or the mothers and fathers of those people or other people. So the impact on other people has to be soberly considered. Another was that, in my experience, you excommunicate one person, you really excommunicate generations. Those of you who read the book on the lost apostles and all of those people who were originally held in high positions, where are their children and their grandchildren and their great-grandchildren? Most of them are not in the church. A third one was that the chances of unjust or arbitrary excommunication seem to me to be rather great. One can see this in the classic examples like Helmut Huber, like Galileo, and one can name Joan of Arc and other people in which the excommunication was clearly, in retrospect, a large mistake, which very often is not undone or is undone later. That is to be vindicated 400 years after you were excommunicated. It does not feel so good after you've been excommunicated, although Galileo avoided it, he might have been, or to be beatified, as Joan of Arc was, or to be have your membership restored, as Helmut Huber did, does not really help the person who is the subject of that. I have a good friend who's a psychotherapist in Southern California who has been a bishop twice, been in a couple of state presidencies, and he said this, where does he say it? Oh, he says on page 3, and then on page priesthood. This is what he said, which I thought was really interesting. Here is a man of some great both experience in psychotherapy and in church discipline. I think we made a fair number of mistakes, or at least didn't use the occasion to optimal advantage in helping people when we held courts. When I reflect upon the whole business in some depth, I'm not sure that they are more helpful, that is, courts are more helpful than just plain spiritual counseling, except in extreme cases. I no longer have access to the church manuals, but the ones I had access to were not helpful with respect to the redemptive process. On balance, based on my experience, I think such counsels cause more problems than they cure. One of the other problems with excommunication is that, as we all know, church doctrine does not stay stable. We have the illusion that it does, but recent announcements about lacks in priesthood, a primary example of that. My wife's great-grandfather, I believe it was, lived in southern Idaho. His wife had a baby, and she said she needed some outing flannel. She sent him to ZCMI to get some. He went to ZCMI, and they were out. So he went to the Gentile store and bought outing flannel and was excommunicated for having done so, having shopped at the Gentile store. So whatever you do, shop at ZCMI. Another really good example of this is that in the 19th century, Apostle Orson Pratt taught that God was omniscient, and the rest of the Quorum and Brigham Young did not believe that. And so the rest of the Quorum wanted to excommunicate Orson Pratt, whereas Brigham Young and the rest of the Quorum believed that God was increasing in his knowledge. Fast forward to Gene England and to Bruce R. McConkie, and when Gene was suggesting that possibly God was still increasing in knowledge, Bruce McConkie called this one of the seven heresies of modern Mormonism. So in 100 years, he moved 180 degrees on a particular doctrinal subject. Theodore Parker, a contemporary of Emerson, observed in a treatise called The Discourse on the Transient and Permanent in Christianity, quote, "The heresy of one age is the orthodox belief and the only infallible rule of the next. Now Arius and now Athanasius." These are the third century disputants over the nature of the Trinity. Now one, now the other, is Lord of the Ascendant. Both were excommunicated in their turn, each for affirming what the other denied. Men are burned for professing what men are burned for denying. Women too. So, one of the things that Nadine suggested, which is something that I think should be clearly part of the training of ecclesiastical leaders, is let's make a distinction between those sins that might be considered moral transgressions of some significance and things that might have to do with what we call heresy or issues relating to doctrine. Generally, a person who is excommunicated or called into disciplinary court for an egregious moral misstep, like adultery or child abuse or something of that nature, already knows that this is wrong, and therefore often is in a position to want to repent and to be changed, and even sometimes to love. I have a friend who was in a disciplinary court last night in Los Angeles, in Northern California, and he said, "Yeah, I've done things that I shouldn't have done, and I'm willing to take whatever the council says is appropriate." When it comes to matters of doctrine, however, it's often very different. The excommunicate, the person excommunicated, very seldom says, "Oh, I was wrong in this doctrinal matter." They often become more entrenched, in fact, in that. And therefore, the lines become drawn, become more rigid. In my classes at JTU and UC Berkeley, we discuss Kister Stendahl, who was former dean of the Harvard Divinity School and the former bishop of Lutheran bishop of Sweden, who came up with a term called holy envy. And it's we see things in others' religion that we wish were in our own. And it's very interesting that they have holy envy about continuing revelation. They say, boy, we wish because their canon is closed and ours is open. And so they have holy envy about a number of other things in the Latter-day Saint tradition. And I tell them that I have holy envy for some things in theirs. And one of the things I have holy envy for is in Catholicism, you can be excommunicated, but you never cease being a Catholic. You are not unbaptized. You are always a Catholic. Your privileges of membership may be suspended. Excommunication means no communion. Very often Catholics are denied communion if they're in that state. But they don't stop being Catholics. And the wonderful thing about that, it seems to me, is that if we instituted that, it would not involve the cancellation of temple ceilings. It would not involve the cancellation of baptism. I think those are such draconian steps that, again, only in the instance of someone who is so outrageous in their moral behavior that they do represent a threat to the church and to individual members. Whatever the outcome of the current cases, and I always hope for the best, I believe that it's up to all of us as individual members to pray for hope, faith, and charity for them, for their families, and for their ecclesiastical leaders, especially charity, which, as Moroni reminds us, is the pure love of Christ. If church courts are indeed courts of love, as they are often called, then there may be no greater call for the pure love of Christ to be manifest than in such courts. I've been, as a bishop, as a member of the High Council, on a number of occasions, I have been involved in church courts or church councils. I have seen them both as courts of love and of courts of something that I would say is much less than loved. One of the things that I also know is that when a person is subject to excommunication or church discipline, very often the worst punishment for them is what happens in the congregation. They feel excommunicated not simply from the ecclesiastical body, but from the membership. Based on the experience of many who have been excommunicated in the past, when Latter-day Saint has excommunicated, often he or she is shunned or ostracized, and thus experience the literal meaning of excommunication, that is, cut off from the community, communion meaning the community itself. Not only that is from the sacraments, but from fellowship. Often such individuals are treated as strangers and foreigners, or even as enemies or contaminated members to be avoided. But according to the Savior's seminal sermon in Matthew 25, Jesus puts himself in the place of the excommunicate. He puts himself in the place of Kate Kelly, or of Margaret Toscano, or Paul, or any of the others who have been excommunicated. Excommunicated often is among those considered the least. Whatever happens with the current cases, this was written before Kate's decision. Whatever happens in the current cases, my earnest hope is that both my fellow members and the church itself, the subjects of these disciplinary courts, will be seen not as strangers and foreigners, but fellow citizens of the saints and of the household of God, as we, their brothers and sisters, enfold them in the arms of our love and fellowship them, mourning and weeping with them, and thus witnessing to both them and to God the abundance of both God's love and ours. Houston, we have a problem. If you've seen the movie Apollo 13, that movie happened. We hear today, they're saying, Houston, we have a problem. There is absolutely no way any feeling human being attempting to be whatever version of Christ-like they have concluded to be there could disagree with anything that has been said in this session. Mark Twain wrote 4 months before he adopted the name of Mark Twain, a little short story about a petrified man. It's very relevant. He could have discredited it or discounted it later in his life. He did not. And here's why. Some of you may know that what he was doing is the Civil War. The Anaconda Plan had choked off the Mississippi. He could no longer be a riverboat captain. He did not want to fight in the Confederacy, so he ran away to where his brother was, out here in these mountains, a little farther east of where we are. And he banged around with his brother, ended up in a newspaper as a hawker. This is what he wrote about that job. To find, and this is in response to a news story, a sensational news story about the finding of a petrified man in Australia. To find a petrified man, or break a stranger's leg, or cave an imaginary mine, or discover some dead Indians in a Gold Hill tunnel, or massacre a family at Dutch Nick's, were feats and calamities that we never hesitated about devising when the public needed matters of thrilling interest for breakfast. The seemingly tranquil enterprise office, name of the newspaper, was a ghastly factory of slaughter, mutilation, and general destruction in those days. Fast forward to the Illuminati and Dan Brown. Last night, Gary Shepard made a very interesting observation at the end of the evening. He said, Sunstone has been a catalyst for change. Oh, it has. And you're part of that. One of the changes that Sunstone has now impacted on us and folks to the south of us down here, the great and spacious building, is the new red letter is now E for excommunication. In 1850, Nathaniel Hawthorne stitched the red A on somebody's clothing. Since 1993, we have made the stitching of a red E a mission. But our mission is to somehow get rid of it. Well, let me take a slightly different perspective. Remember what Mark Twain said, Sunstone gives us a platform, as I say this, Sunstone gives us a platform and a voice to those of us that have been silenced because we're Jesuits in Mormonism. That doesn't work. Now, are we going to silence our dissent by dissenting in the wrong order? Please don't forget that. Robert Rees opened this conference by talking about Tikkun Olam. This is the first of 4 points I will make. And then he called upon us to tikkun ourselves first, and then to tikkun kanesi. I think that's how you said it. Is that right?
Say it boldly, nobody will care.
In English, change yourself first and stop pointing fingers. Is that better? Is that better? That's a clever thing. So let me give you some context. A court, we're here to talk about how they instigate, investigate, and intrude in the hearing. That's what the paragraph says. So let me give you some context. The Doctrine and Covenants outlines exactly what happens in a court. A
and it guarantees there are two sides. I'm going to take the other side as an invitation for us to cocoon ourselves before we cocoon Kinesi, which I fully support. Okay, number one, before we can really say anything about what's going on, let's reflect on the fact that we're sitting here because we can afford it. We had a meal today, we have clothes on our back, we're literate, and we're relatively closer to the top of the Maslowian pyramid than anyone else in the history of the world. That's the world in which we are now operating, with this thing as our companion, which, by the way, only happened 5 years ago. Don't forget that word. So, as Michael Quinn so clearly said yesterday, we now have a complete capacity to be utterly selfish and talk only of ourselves and protect only our feelings. Interesting. You ever notice that the logo for Apple computer is an apple with a bite out of it, which is the source of all evil, according to most of the Christian world? So if you're an Apple user, you are consuming evil. It's a subtle trick. Number two, we are now the victims of the seduction of the soundbite. My reference to Dan Brown was not made lightly. Our hunger for the sensational often blinds our ability to decoon ourselves. I am not here to give a sermon. I'm a scientist. I simply want to remind you of the big lie. The source of all social psychology was Hitler, Goebbels, propaganda. The ability to move large groups of people emotionally because they themselves were annoyed. That's what Dan Brown does. He carries us around all sorts of mysteries, the theme of the Illuminati and conspiracy. I don't know if you're aware of the fact that the Wasatch Front is considered and has been considered for at least 4 decades the scam capital of the world. The FBI has its largest office in the world, anti-fraud office, here, because the folks that are the legacy of this culture are easily duped, easily scammed. And I remind you that Moses and his folks were in the wilderness 40 years, Sunstone's been around 40. But, you know, we've only really been in this world of selective communication since 1993. And Moses didn't get in, just for what it's worth. So it might be a while. So, now that I sound like I'm a true believer and a defender and apologist, I came here from Las Vegas where I facilitated a convention for Hooters. And there's more than Hooters that makes me happy. What makes me happy is this. I came here because those that are silent can speak, and I've heard them speak. This church is an organism. It's an organization. It is an organism. It is organic. It is growing. It is changing. And whenever it finds an Ebola virus, or whenever it finds anything that scares it, and remember the heritage of the people in this valley is persecution. My father-in-law came here and left the church because he said, after he'd been in for 2 years, he said, you folks are just consumed with the persecution complex. That was 20 years ago. He was right. We don't know it. And just because the white blood cells of the organism are giving us a little difficulty about its communication right now doesn't mean that it's going to go away. Again, Twain said, loyalty to a petrified opinion, then may have broken chain or freed a human soul. What do we have to do? Brother Reese, if I may, I was a bishop the same year on the opposite coast. And 17 years later, the same thing happened to me. It happened to you in that gospel doctrine class, but it was in a hospital waiting room. My wife was undergoing really serious surgery. I was in the surgery waiting room. And this monster of a man walks up to me. And I'm sitting there, I look up. A little frightening. And he says, are you Russ Osmond? I said, yeah. I stood up. He said, do you remember me? When I saw his eyes, I remembered it. His name was Rocky. And he said, what you did in that disciplinary conversation we had 17 years ago worked. Thank you. And he went on to report the same thing. Love in an organism is very, very difficult. So I want to give you a way to think about it that may help. Over there you see an iceberg, if you can see it. 10% of the iceberg is above the water, 90% is below. The point is this: science, neuroscience. We are all two people. We are a person that talks, and we are a person that reacts. The part of us that other people see is the part that talks. But who we are, 90% of us, the part that sinks the Titanic, is the part below the waterline. It's how we feel. And we come here to heal. Interesting. Well, over on this board is a very interesting model from brain science about how the brain develops. On the left it says brain. A lot of science behind this. I don't have time to bore you with the science. I'll be glad to send it to you if you want. But from birth, the way the brain wires itself, the baby is organizing itself around those four concepts: ideas, facts, actions, and feelings, asking four questions. The idea question is why, the fact question is what, the action question is how, and the feeling question is who, about trust. When a baby first begins to talk in any culture, in any language, they ask lots of why and what. They're in the context, idea area, and the fact area. Then eventually they get into things. Eat dirt, touch the stove, flood their brother. That's action. Then, when they don't know what they want, they scream. That's feelings. And until the age of 11, 12, 13, depending on where we're from, this is universal, by the way, we have four meanings for every word, and we're not aware of it. It's not until we get to high school that we end up with a preference. And by the time we come out of high school and get into the workplace, we tend to forget that our brain can look at things four ways because every word has four meanings, and we have a preference. Some of us are very analytical, factual. Some of us are out in the ozone, crazy, very creative. Some of us are very oriented to obedience, and some of us are easily hurt. Now look at the second column. Here's how we react. In exactly the opposite order. The 90% of who we are, which also, by the way, is in cement by the time we are 11, and that never changes, is first with feelings, then with actions, then with facts to defend our actions, and then with purpose. Our reactions are like Vesuvius. Vesuvius blows, the gas comes out, Pompeii freezes. Freezes. Because of the gas in the dust, and we freeze and get stuck. We get stuck in a petrified place because we're reacting. The reason you have a blank page in the program is to invite you to unfreeze. This is not an attempt to sell anything. Please, it's free, okay?
Russ, we have about 2 minutes.
Yeah. So the question I want you to ask yourself is very simple. Do you want to unfreeze? Oh, I forgot to mention, all of us, because of the research that's been done since the Second World War, are motivated and driven by the same 8 things, and it defines our faith. And if we define our faith properly, we then understand why we are reacting. So let us take care of ourselves, understand our reactions, complete the profile, it's confidential, and give you the insight, but more importantly, it'll help you understand what is petrified about you as you attempt to decoon Kanasi, which is what Satsang does. And as you attempt to first decoon yourself, and never forget, when you look at it from the eyes of the apostle, they have a hell of a life. It is an awful life. They cry. The church is brokenhearted with compassion over canceling seedings. They have swung all the way over here, down there, trying to help. It takes a little while for the bureaucracy to catch up. So yes, we need process. And you're right. Yes, we need forgiveness and patience. Bob, you're right. We have to start with ourselves. So that's the other side of the story. Thank you. I hope we'll talk about it.
Some Sensen sessions are too long, some are too short. This one's too short, because we don't have time for that. But Nadine wanted to say one thing about her particular case.
When I was speaking, I told you I would. You can't. You can hear me in the back. Oh, okay. Well, I'll just talk louder. When I was speaking, I said I would tell you how to easily find the briefs that I wrote for Kate Kelly. So for the appellate brief, the easiest way to find it is to go to the ordainedwomen.org website, and down in the left-hand corner, there's a link to her appeal. First brief that went to her bishop, the easiest way to find it is to Google WikiLeaks Kate Kelly brief, and you don't need any quotes. And that was the easiest way that I found to find it. It's on the Ordained Women website also, but it's kind of buried now.
Right, and there's a little bit of time for the next meeting, so if some of you want to hang around and ask any questions with the panelists, please feel free to do yourself.